The House and Senate are in recess. The House will return on Tuesday, April 9th, while the Senate will return Monday, April 8th. Last week in the House came back on Tuesday and voted to pass two bills under suspension of the rules. On Wednesday, the House took up and passed a rule governing floor consideration of H.R. 1023 to repeal Section 134 of the Clean Air Act relating to the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, H.R. 1121, the Protecting American Energy Production Act, H.R. 6009, the Restoring American Energy Dominance Act, and H.R. 7023, the Creating Confidence in Clean Water Permitting Act. In addition, that rule governed floor consideration of the concurrent resolution, H.Con. Res. 86, expressing the sense of Congress that a carbon tax would be detrimental to the United States economy, and H.Res. 987, denouncing the harmful anti-American energy policies of the Biden administration. Then the House passed a bill under suspension of the rules. Then the House took up H.R. 1121, the Protecting American Energy Production Act, and passed it by a vote of 229 to 188 with 15 Democrats crossing over and not a single Republican going the other way. Then the House took up and passed H.R. 6009, the Restoring American Energy Dominance Act. On Thursday, the House took up and passed H.Res. 987, denouncing the harmful anti-American energy policies of the Biden administration by a vote of 217 to 200. Then the House took up and passed H.Con. Res. 86, expressing the sense of Congress that a carbon tax would be detrimental to the United States economy by a vote of 222 to 196. Then the House passed a bill under suspension of the rules. And then the House took up H.R. 7023, the Creating Confidence in Clean Water Permitting Act, and began considering amendments. One amendment was offered, but it was defeated. The House then voted on the unamended bill, and it passed by a vote of 213 to 205. The House came back on Friday to vote on the sixth bill megabus appropriations package, also known as the second larger government funding bill, and it passed under suspension of the rules by a vote of 286 to 134. We'll talk more about that bill in a moment. The House took up and passed H.R. 1023 to repeal Section 134 of the Clean Air Act relating to the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund by a vote of 209 to 204. And then they were done. Last week in the Senate came back on Tuesday and voted to confirm Nicole G. Berner to be a U.S. Circuit Judge for the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. On Wednesday, the Senate voted to invoke cloture on and then to confirm the nominations of Edward Sunyol Keel to be a U.S. District Judge for the District of New Jersey and Yumi K. Lee to be a U.S. District Judge for the Northern District of California. On Thursday, the Senate voted to reconsider invoking cloture on the nomination of Jose Javier Rodriguez to be an Assistant Secretary of Labor. Then the Senate voted to confirm him to that position. Then the Senate voted to pass SJ Res 62, a joint resolution providing for congressional disapproval under the Congressional Review Act of the rules submitted by the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service relating to importation of fresh beef from Paraguay. The resolution of disapproval passed by a vote of 70 to 25. On Friday, the Senate voted to confirm Ernest Gonzalez to be a U.S. District Judge for the Western District of Texas. Then the Senate voted by 78 to 18 to agree to the motion to proceed to H.R. 2882, the Megabus Appropriations Bill. But the Senate leadership had not yet finalized a time agreement, so the Senate took a vote to confirm Leon Scheidlauer to be a U.S. District Judge for the Western District of Texas. And then the Senate got stuck. Remember, everything in the Senate runs on unanimous consent. That's how they bypass the time constraints that would otherwise require the Senate to take days or even weeks to get through its agenda. In this case, there was a two-week recess coming up, and everyone wanted to get out of town, so finding what's called a time agreement was a priority. That crippled the majority leader, because everyone knew that he would have to give the Republicans a lot of what they wanted in order to get all the Republicans to agree to his time demands. If even one Republican senator wanted to block the unanimous consent request, that lone Republican could have held the Senate up at least until Sunday and probably longer. But midnight Friday night was the deadline for action on the funding bill, so Schumer had to give the other side a lot of what they wanted. And what they wanted was votes on amendments that they could later use against Democrats in tough election campaigns. But there was another problem. Schumer was caught between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, he couldn't allow any amendment to pass, because if it passed, it would change the bill. And then the House would have to vote on the amended bill before it could be sent to the president for his signature. But the House had already left town, so that would have meant a shutdown, and Schumer certainly didn't want to allow that. So he couldn't agree to a vote on any amendment that he thought would pass. There was one amendment in particular that Schumer did not want to allow the Republicans to vote on. North Carolina Republican Senator Ted Budd had taken the Laken Riley Act, which had passed the House a few weeks ago and was going absolutely nowhere in the Schumer-controlled Senate, and turned it into an amendment he wanted to offer to the spending bill. Schumer didn't want to allow this amendment to be offered. He wanted to protect his vulnerable red state senators, John Tester in Montana, Sherrod Brown in Ohio. And he didn't want Bob Casey in Pennsylvania or Jackie Rosen in Nevada or even Tammy Baldwin in Wisconsin to have to vote on it either. Consequently, the senators were at a standoff, and neither side would budge. Schumer wouldn't agree to any amendment schedule that included a vote on the Budd Amendment, and Senator McConnell wouldn't agree to any amendment schedule that did not include it. The Senate essentially shut down for 6 hours on Friday night as the midnight deadline approached. And then finally, at 11:56 p.m., that is 4 minutes before technically funding would expire for about 70% of the government, Schumer blinked, and the Senate had its time agreement locked in and began voting on amendments. It showed the value of a determined minority with a plan and a leadership that can get everyone to stick together. House Republicans could have learned a thing or two. First up was an amendment offered by Utah Republican Senator Mike Lee to defund the use of the U.S. Customs and Border Protection CBP-1 app to facilitate the entry of any alien into the United States. That amendment was defeated by a vote of 45-51. Then came a motion to refer with instructions offered by Kentucky Republican Senator Rand Paul, which would have sent the bill back to the Appropriations Committee with instructions that the committee cut 5% of the spending from the bill. That motion to refer was defeated by a vote of 34-63. Next came a motion to concur with a motion to table. In other words, the Senate was voting to agree to kill an amendment numbered 1804, offered by Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz, that would have prohibited the Biden administration from issuing waivers giving Iran access to escrowed accounts, including a $10 billion account related to Iraqi electricity. The motion to kill the Cruz amendment carried by a vote of 51-47. The next vote was a similar vote, a motion to table, that is, to kill an amendment offered by a Republican. This time, the amendment came from Alabama Senator Tommy Tuberville, who took his Protection of Women and Girls in Sports Act, which he originally introduced in 2022, but which had never yet had a floor vote in the Senate because Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has blocked it, and turned it into an amendment to the spending bill. The amendment would have prevented funds passed in the spending bill from going to K-12 schools and institutions of higher education that permit biological males to participate in sports and activities designed for women and girls. The motion to kill the amendment carried by a vote of 51-47. Next up was a motion to concur in the amendment offered by Missouri Republican Senator Eric Schmidt, numbered 1795. The Schmidt Amendment would have prohibited the use of funding from the bill to label speech as disinformation or misinformation, or to coerce online platforms to alter, remove, restrict, or suppress speech. The amendment was defeated by a vote of 51-47. Then came a vote on an amendment offered by Wisconsin Republican Senator Ron Johnson. His amendment, numbered 1706, would have prohibited the disbursement of certain federal funding to local jurisdictions that refused to provide advance notice to the Department of Homeland Security regarding the release of illegal aliens from local custody. In other words, it would have defunded sanctuary cities. The motion to table, that is, to kill, the Johnson Amendment, carried by a vote of, you guessed it, 51-47. Then came three voice votes, which don't have a record of the vote other than to say the three amendments failed. Following the three voice votes, the Senate went back to recorded votes. This time, Majority Leader Schumer offered his own blocking amendments to keep the Senate from being forced to vote on amendments offered by Republicans. First, Ted Budd tried to offer his version of the Laken-Riley Act as an amendment. In order to do that, he first offered a motion to table the Schumer blocking amendment. That is, Senator Budd tried to kill Senator Schumer's attempt to block Senator Budd's amendment. The Budd motion to table was rejected by a vote of 47-51. Then Tennessee Republican Senator Bill Hagerty wanted to offer an amendment that would have defunded the Biden administration's practice of flying in illegal immigrants to Blue City airports at taxpayer expense. Again, Senator Schumer offered a blocking motion. So Senator Hagerty's motion was a motion to table the Schumer blocking amendment. Senator Hagerty's motion to table was rejected by a vote of 47-51. Finally, Senator Budd came back and wanted to offer another amendment. This amendment would have prevented aliens from becoming legal or allowing them to become citizens if they had assaulted a law enforcement officer. Again, Senator Schumer put in place a blocking amendment. So Senator Budd offered a motion to table Schumer's blocking amendment. But Senator Budd's motion to table was rejected by a vote of 47-51. Then, finally, mercifully, at 1:51 a.m. on Saturday morning, almost 2 hours past their deadline, the Senate voted by 74-24 to pass the megabus spending bill. And then they were done. Now to the latest on the post-McConnell contest for Senate GOP leadership. Another week, another entrant into the Senate Republican Leadership Contest sweepstakes. You'll remember that last week, the new entrant was West Virginia Senator Shelley Moore Capito, who had decided to try to move up one rung on the leadership ladder by moving from her current position as the fifth-ranking member of the leadership by moving from vice chair of the Senate GOP conference to the number four position as chair of the Senate GOP Policy Committee. Well, that opens up a slot as vice chair of the Senate GOP conference. Into the breach steps Oklahoma Senator James Lankford, perhaps best known for his recent efforts to negotiate a border deal. While it's true that a majority of his GOP colleagues chose to vote against his final work product, it's also true that once former President Trump came out against the final work product, there was very little chance that a majority of Senate Republicans were going to vote for it. Meanwhile, on Wednesday of last week, Senate Republicans held a special meeting of their conference to discuss a mission statement and goals for the conference, and the process that would be used to elect a new Senate Republican leader. The special meeting was held at the request of Senators Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, Tommy Tuberville of Alabama, Roger Marshall of Kansas, J.D. Vance of Ohio, Josh Hawley of Missouri, Mike Lee of Utah, Marco Rubio of Florida, Jim Risch of Idaho, Mike Braun of Indiana, and Rick Scott of Florida. Now to the latest on non-citizen voting. The week before last, the Senate Judiciary Committee held a hearing on the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, the Democrats' attempt to federalize all election administration, which the Constitution specifically leaves to the states, and for good reason. And something very interesting happened. Under questioning by Utah Republican Senator Mike Lee, witnesses who had been selected by the Democrat majority refused to say they thought voting should be limited to U.S. citizens. Lee asked all the witnesses to answer with a simple yes or no to two questions about non-citizen voting. The first question was about as simple as could be, quote, Do you believe that only citizens of the United States should be able to vote in federal elections? The second question was almost as simple. He asked whether, quote, people registering to vote should provide documentary proof of their citizenship in order to register to vote. The witnesses selected by the Democrat majority were Lydia Camarillo, president of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, in San Antonio, Texas, Sophia Lynn Lakin, director of the Voting Rights Project of the American Civil Liberties Union in New York, New York, and Damon T. Hewitt, president and executive director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law of Montgomery, Maryland. None of the three of them could answer either question with a simple yes or no, and each of them made clear through their answers that they really wished they could come right out and say, of course not, but we're afraid to, because of the obvious negative political consequences of such an answer. By contrast, the two witnesses selected by the committee minority, Hans von Spakovsky, manager of the Election Law Reform Initiative and senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C., and Maureen Reardon, litigation counsel at the Public Interest Legal Foundation in Alexandria, Virginia, had no trouble answering that they believed non-citizens should not be able to vote, and they agreed that voters should be required to prove citizenship to register. Now let's talk about President Biden's electric vehicle non-mandate mandate. On Wednesday of last week, the Biden administration rolled out new greenhouse gas emission standards for automobiles that are so stringent they are effectively a new electric vehicle mandate. Though administration officials are doing their best to keep a straight face while they lie through their teeth as they insist the emission standards are not, in fact, a new EV mandate, everyone with a brain in his head knows otherwise. Here's the way it works. The Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, has issued a new standard for emissions that requires that gasoline-powered automobiles can make up no more than 30% of auto sales by 2032. The administration is offering the auto companies billions of dollars in subsidies to assist them in the transition to the new EV world. The auto companies are going to need those subsidies because the vast majority of Americans don't want EVs. Last year, for instance, EVs made up less than 8% of new auto sales, and more than half of the ones that did sell were Teslas. Electric vehicles accounted for less than 4% of sales for GM and Ford. As the Wall Street Journal editorial board points out, foreign automakers like Mercedes, BMW, and Porsche, each of whom had more than 10% of their sales last year being EVs, will have an easier time selling their customers on EVs simply because their rich client base can afford the darn things. Yes, these things are expensive. The average cost of a new EV is about $50,000. The auto companies are losing money on each electric vehicle they sell, not a sustainable business model. Ford lost almost $5 billion on its EV business last year. That's equivalent to losing almost $65,000 for every EV they sold. Republicans push back. Senators Pete Ricketts of Nebraska and Dan Sullivan of Alaska said they would be introducing Congressional Review Act legislation to overturn the new EV mandate. This is the kind of thing that has the potential to become a major campaign issue between Biden and Trump this fall. Stay tuned. Now to the latest update on banning TikTok. The Senate did not move on the TikTok bill last week. The members of two committees in the Senate, the Commerce Committee and the Intelligence Committee, sat for briefings from officials of the FBI, the Department of Justice, and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. They had the same reaction to the information they received as did their counterparts in the House when they received the same briefings a few weeks ago. It led Republicans and Democrats to have the same two reactions after the hearing. First, they said TikTok, under Chinese Communist Party control, as it is now, as a business entity controlled by a Chinese-based company, is a threat to U.S. national security. TikTok has the ability to scoop up data on its 170 million American users and send it to the CCCP. Further, the algorithms TikTok uses in the United States are different from the algorithms it uses in China. Consequently, what American users see in their feed is very different from what Chinese users see in their feed. Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz, the ranking member of the Commerce Committee, said this, quote, "The content on TikTok in China is pushing things like math and science and education and hard work and discipline. And here in the United States, the Chinese Communist Party is pushing things to our kids like self-harm and suicide. They're studying math and science, and they're trying to get our kids to chew on Tide Pods. That is deeply concerning." The second thing all the senators said is that the briefing they received, which was classified, should be declassified and shared with the American public as soon as possible. Said Connecticut Democrat Richard Blumenthal, quote, "I will say very emphatically, the American people need and deserve to hear what we've just been told, because they would be deeply frightened. There is absolutely no reason to keep it secret. There are no sources or methods that may be endangered." Commerce Committee Chairwoman Maria Cantwell, Democrat of Washington State, plans to work on the bill after the Senate returns from its current two-week recess. She initially seemed to be opposed to the bill, but may be rethinking her position. Stay tuned. Now, let's talk just a little bit more about government funding. We discussed at length what happened in the Senate Friday night and Saturday morning. That was the last step in funding the government for fiscal year 2024. Which we're already almost halfway through. The fiscal year runs from October 1 to September 30, so fiscal year 2025 begins on October 1, just 6 months and 1 week from now. The two appropriations bills passed, the minibus that passed 2 weeks ago and the megabus that passed early Saturday morning, total about $1.66 trillion in discretionary spending for FY24. The fiscal year 2025 budget process has gotten off to a late start, courtesy of President Biden's tardiness in submitting his budget request. By law, he's required to submit that request to Congress on the first Monday in February. This year, he missed that deadline by more than a month. The various authorizing committees have begun conducting hearings with cabinet secretaries on the various budget proposals. Those will continue for several more weeks after the Congress returns from its Easter recess. Now let's talk about the Green motion to vacate. On Friday morning, as the House was voting on final passage of the $1.2 trillion six-bill megabus funding package, Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene filed a motion to vacate the speakership against Speaker Mike Johnson. She did not ask for privilege, so there is no requirement that the House leadership bring the business of the House to a screeching halt and vote on the matter immediately. Asked by reporters why she had filed it, if she was going to file it in such a manner that it wouldn't have to actually be voted on, she said she filed it as a warning and a pink slip, and said House Republicans would have to begin the process of selecting a new leader. Now let's talk about the emergency supplemental, that is the foreign aid bill. There was no movement on the Ukraine-Israel foreign aid supplemental spending bill last week, other than former Republican Congressman Ken Buck's decision to sign the Democrat discharge petition to get the Senate passed supplemental bill on the floor. Paradoxically, though I think Buck signed the petition out of a sincere belief that the U.S. should continue providing assistance to Ukraine, I think it's likely that his signature, he was the first Republican to defy the Republican leadership to sign the Democrat petition, will likely prevent other Republicans from adding their names to the petition. He's become toxic inside the House Republican Conference. So his move really doesn't help those trying to get aid to Ukraine. Meanwhile, Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene's filing of a motion to vacate against Speaker Mike Johnson wasn't really aimed at punishing for his decision to bring two spending bills to the floor. It was aimed at warning him not to bring a Ukraine aid bill to the floor. So he's got that to consider as he thinks about how to handle the Ukraine funding bill when the House comes back from its recess in 2 weeks. Now let's talk about anti-Trump lawfare. New York Attorney General Letitia James seems to be virtually salivating at the prospect of seizing former President Donald Trump's assets. She may rue the day she brought her civil fraud case against him. Her action may well end up sending him back to the White House. James infamously campaigned for office in 2018 on a promise to go after Trump. "I will be shining a bright light into every dark corner of his real estate dealings, demanding truthfulness at every turn," she said on the campaign trail. Like Andrei Vyshinsky, Stalin's procurator general who oversaw the criminal trials of the Great Purge and has been cited as the source of the fabled prosecutor's assertion, "Give me a man and I will find the crime," James had her target and simply needed to find the crime. That concept is offensive to the rule of law. Further, despite the fact that when she was elected, he was serving as president of the United States, she wasted no time searching for a crime she could hang around Trump's neck. After all, while campaigning for the job in 2018, she had said, "I believe that the president of the United States can be indicted for criminal offenses." She had a campaign promise to keep, no matter what the longstanding policy of the Federal Department of Justice may have been. It took her 3 years to figure out what case to bring, but eventually James had her charge, civil fraud, in a case where no bank that lent money to Trump did anything other than make profits off its loans to Trump. As the Wall Street Journal editorial board wrote, there was no real financial victim. But that was all right because the law James chose to use to go after Trump required no finding that anyone had been injured. She merely had to prove to a judge's satisfaction that Trump had committed fraud. Consequently, the money that the judge ordered Trump to pay will go to the state, not to any alleged victim. The judgment is not meant to compensate any alleged victim for money fraudulently taken. Instead, the judgment is meant to punish Trump and remove as much money as possible from his assets so as to reduce his ability to contribute to his own campaign for president. So, if there was no real financial victim, how did the court arrive at the stupendous amount of $354 million as the proper amount to fine Trump once the court had found him guilty? Simple. The court accepted James's figures for how much the fraud had earned him in ill-gotten gains, and then levied that amount as his fine so as to disgorge him of the improperly taken booty. And don't forget the interest. Already pegged at another $110 million and increasing by another $112,000 per day, which began accruing before Trump was even found guilty. Yes, you heard that right. Judge Engeron ruled that the interest Trump owes on roughly half of the total penalty amount, related to savings Trump was given on loans he received, can be calculated from the beginning of the investigation. That was in 2019. It's galling enough that Trump has been ordered to pay a huge fine that includes interest that began accruing on the day the state launched its investigation. What's even worse is that the fine and the interest are so large, they may effectively deny him the right to appeal. Because in order to appeal the verdict, he's required by state law to post a bond in the amount of the outstanding balance. And the kinds of companies that regularly offer such bonds don't typically accept as collateral for a loan of that magnitude the kinds of assets that make up the vast bulk of his wealth, real estate. Consequently, Trump's attorneys told the judge last week that they've been unable to secure a bond. Trump may have to sell off one or more of his iconic properties, likely at fire sale prices, just to be able to post a bond to allow him to appeal the verdict against him. That is, he may have to sell off property that he most likely wouldn't be able to recover, even after a successful appeal, just to be able to enjoy the protections of the due process that is supposed to be one of the hallmarks of the American legal system. So Trump owes $464 million to the state of New York for taking out loans from banks that were perfectly willing to loan money to him after doing their own due diligence on the value of the properties involved in the transactions, and then paying back the loans with enough interest that the banks made a tidy profit, good enough that they were willing to continue doing business with him. That's absurd, And it's outrageous. It's election interference. It's a deliberate attempt by a partisan actor to abuse the powers of her office to hurt a political opponent, while simultaneously stripping that political opponent of a huge amount of cash that he could have used to fund his own campaign for the presidency. It's also overkill. And just as the ridiculous criminal cases launched against Trump have failed to convince Republican primary voters not to support him, the James case against Trump, launched no doubt for political purposes, will fail. This case may, in fact, be so over the top that it pushes some voters out of the Biden and undecided columns and into the Trump camp, cementing a Trump return to the White House despite Letitia James' fondest hopes, and she will have no one to blame but herself. Just before I sat down to record this week's news update, the Associated Press Wire had a breaking news story to update this update. I'm going to quote directly from the AP Wire here. Quote, "A New York appeals court on Monday agreed to hold off collection of former President Donald Trump's $454 million civil fraud judgment if he puts up $175 million within 10 days. If he does, it will stop the clock on collection and prevent the state from seizing his assets while he appeals." The development came just before New York Attorney General Letitia James was expected to initiate efforts to collect the judgment. End quote. Now to the latest on The Jenny Beth Show. Episode 58 of The Jenny Beth Show dropped last Wednesday, following the previous week's interview with former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann. This week's episode features Jenny Beth's interview with former Congressman Steve King. The episode is entitled "The Pillars of American Exceptionalism," and in it they talk about how he got to Congress, the early days of the Tea Party movement, and the struggles facing conservatives today. Highly recommended. And that's our Washington report for this week.